Hey there, everybody. Aaron Noonan here. Welcome along to the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. And on this episode, well, in fact, this is one of two parts of a sit-down chat that I had very recently with the great Fred Gibson, of course, driver, team manager, team owner. He's worn all the caps and won plenty of races in his time on both sides of the pit wall. We split his chat into two parts because there were so many things to talk about. So part two comes up next week. This is part one, and we talk about how he got into motorsport in the first place. We chat about his driving career. Of course, he drove sports cars and open wheelers and then touring cars. And of course, the time that he evolved in the 80s to becoming the team owner of the Nissan team that, of course, everyone knew as Gibson Motorsport. We got so many great National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions that we've spread them across both parts of our chat with FG. He was in very good form when I saw him very recently, the Hall of Famer. It was great to sit down with him. Some funny stories, some great insights. Here we go. Buckle up. Time to start part one of Fred Gibson on the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. FG, on the V8 Sleuth podcast, we have been asked by literally hundreds of people to track you down and come and have a chat to you and get you on the podcast. Do you know what a podcast is?
No, no idea. I'm getting old, so better tell me.
It's a fancy radio show. That's all it is, really.
Really?
It's another chance for us to tell bullshit. Stories of lies and bullshit, exactly.
Bullshit again. Exactly. There'll be some bullshit in there somewhere.
It's all good. It's all good. Hey, wanted to talk to you about a whole bunch of stuff. There is so many things to talk to you about, and I don't know where to start, but I don't think I've ever asked you, what got you started in racing? Was this a family thing? Where did the bug bite? Because clearly it's never left.
I think one of the problems was is years and years and years ago, I was becoming a demon on the road.
And not a good demon, I'm presuming.
Not a good demon. And, lived in Sydney, and a few of my mates, and we finished up I suppose a group of us had, I had an MGA, mate had a TR3, another guy had a Goggomobile, what else? We have all these cars. We had about six cars, our mates. And what are we going to do? We used to go and lived in Sydney, so the whole thing is lived on the coast. So we used to go late at night out to Bondi, Bondi Beach, and then drive all down the beach roads right down to Maroubra or further down of a night at about midnight and race each other. So this went on for a few months, years and years ago. And the thing is, until all of a sudden one night there was a roadblock and the cobbles were there waiting for us, pulled us all over. So we had to finish up, stop doing that. So I thought, this is not going to work too much longer now. So what I did, I sort of joined a car club, and most of us joined a car club. I think we joined the Southern Sporting Car Club, which was a fairly big in Hurstville in Sydney, because we used to all hang out at the Hurstville pub sometimes and have a few drinks and whatever when we were young. So I started a car club with an MGA, and then I started sort of thinking, well, I need to take it off the road because I can't drive on the road. I'm too quick with it. So I made it into a race car. And as far as that was concerned, then it turned out to be probably the quickest MGA in Australia, was renowned to be. I did all the work at home in the car in my dad's garage at the back of the house in Randwick. He was a bit of a petrol head, and he used to he's an old sheet metal worker, turned into a motor mechanic. So we did a lot of the work in the garage at home at Randwick, and finished up with a Crossflow cylinder head on it, Derrington cylinder head, Jaguar disc brakes on the back of it, close ratio gearbox, and another guy I used to know, Sid Grevitt, who used to race years ago too, and he had an MJ twin cam. And another mate of mine had an MJ twin cam as well, Norton Clayton. He raced that a fair bit. Actually, I finished up racing that car of his in the 6-hour race it might have been at Bathurst.
Oh, okay, yeah.
The Gagans were in the SP250 Daimler, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was on the front row with them in the MGA. So the car turned into a race car, and my dad was a bit of a petrol head, and he had a Vauxhall sedan, the big sedan thing, and we had a trailer. We did a trailer and we trailered it around. So we went to started going to motorsport, Catalina Park and those sort of places.
So was the first road car also the first race car?
Yes.
Because there's my two questions done in one.
It was a road car, it was a road car, finished up as a race car. That was my race car.
Yeah.
And the thing is we trailered and did all the local meetings, Catalina Park and those sort of things, and it just got quicker and quicker and I suppose spent more and more money on it.
How were you funding this? Was he funding it? Yeah, were you funding it?
I was funding it. I was working two jobs then. I worked for the Electricity Commission. I mentioned as an apprentice fitter and turner.
Were you any good?
Not really. I wanted to be a motor mechanic, but I couldn't get a job as an apprentice motor mechanic, so I got a job as a fitter and turner. And I worked at all the power stations in, even Muswellbrook and those places, went and did time at those. So I learnt the machine side of doing things. And it was good money at the time. And like I was doing sort of odd jobs here and there to get extra money and become a bit of a petrol head where I'd fix someone's car and charge them for it and make some money. So I just developed sort of from the street really to be a racer and the MGA become the quickest MGA in Australia.
So a lot of people who become racing drivers have the plan. Yeah. I want to be a race driver.
Yeah.
A lot of guys, I guess, of your era were just inner cars, enthusiast, loved it, loved racing, loved driving, loved tinkering.
Yep.
And it kind of just happened without it being – because at the time, no one is going to sit there and say career pathway 101, car race, professional racing car driver, not even on the radar, surely.
Well, the thing is, I was on the road and was in trouble on the road, wasn't I? Because a fair few fines and things, so that didn't work. And I joined the sporting car club and I raced it when I joined that at Oran Park, at its first race meeting, Oran Park, when the circuit all broke up and this was a beautiful black MGA and it was immaculate condition and everything.
Oh, no.
And I raced it at this Oran Park meeting because I joined the Southern Sporting Car Club and it was an open meeting and raced it there for the first time. And the track broke up so bad that the car looked like it had been shell grit everywhere.
Oh, no.
All the knock-ons were knocked about, the chrome knock-ons and the paint off the front of it. So it half destroyed the car the first race meeting I went there sort of thing. But I had a lot of fun in the car and it was a good car. Then, you get to meet people at racetracks and I met the Gagans probably in some ways and they were the Lotus agents. And I decided to upgrade from the MGA, like production sports car racing. And they got one out themselves and I ordered through them. And I've still got the receipt for the from Gagans for the car.
How much was it, do you remember?
I think it was £6,000 or something. Oof. So it was, back in those days. We used to look after that in the home in Randwick as well, still in the same place. In the backyard sort of thing, really, and raced that, and it was a great little car. And that's when I first met John Shepherd.
Yeah.
Because he was working for Gagans.
Yeah.
And Shepherd was there, and the car was – when I got there, they only just got the car out of the big crate, and they got an extra one out as well, and that was finished up to be Neil Allen's car because he bought the other one later on sort of thing. When he had his E-Type Jaguar, Neil Allen I raced against – with a Lotus, and knowing Neil, like I did back in those days, he wanted to be as good as I was going to be probably, so he had to buy a Lotus Elan. So Gagans raced at once there, and he bought that as well, two Lotus Elans, yeah.
What's the story about the day that you were tinkering away, I think, with your Lotus, it might have been up at Lakeside or somewhere like that, and we won't say who it is, people might be able to figure out who it is, but potentially one of the most famous drivers in world racing history at the time and probably ever, stuck his head in the tent and was
Jimmy Clark.
Keen on your Jimmy Clark wandered into your tent because you had a Lotus. He drove for Lotus in Formula One and Indy cars, Indy 500 and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just unfathomable now.
Well, he was there for the Tasman series.
Yeah,
and
it's amazing.
He was running his Lotus there and we had the Lotus land there, the old man and myself, and we had our tent up. He walked into a little tent.
Just out of the blue?
Out of the blue. He said, "Hi, I'm Jim Clark."
We know.
Hello. Hello. And he walked in and had a cup of tea with us because Dad used to boil the billy in the thing and have a cup of tea. And he talked about the car. He'd been watching the car go around and he said, "It's fantastic." Anyway, cut a long story short, he did a tie deal for me because the front tyres on his Lotus F1 car were the same size as what on the Lotus Elan. And they were Firestone. And he arranged the Firestone to supply tyres for as long as I wanted. And they supplied them free of charge. you know. And I think Savage Tyre Deal or something in Sydney, Granville or somewhere, they were the tyre deal for Firestone, and they still made tyres of them.
So if you applied a modern equivalent, it's kind of like support category team running their car at Albert Park and Lewis Hamilton strides past, sticks his head in and goes, "Oh, your Mercedes GT car's going pretty well. How's your oh, I'll sort you out some tyres for the year. No worries, on your way. And by the way, put the kettle on."
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Amazing how young we were then and how old we are now. But no, it was good. He was terrific. He was really, you know, he watched the car and he organised the whole thing. Didn't cost me a cent.
Yeah. On his insistence. He came up with it. Oh, yeah. You didn't even have to ask. He just did it.
He said, "They're the same size as the front tyres of my car." He said, I'll do a deal for you.
Wow. Pretty cool. Yeah. That's a very cool story.
So Lotus became a pretty famous car, really. Mm. Yeah, it was a good car, and we had good racing with Neil Allen. Neil Allen with his Lotus Elan as well. And it probably learnt me a lot, especially looking after the car and what you had to do and meeting John Shepherd. And John was like a demon on twin cam engines back in the day. And we had bigger carbies put on it, bigger Webbers and all
races,
that sort of stuff.
Races, tweaking, tuning, playing with stuff.
Yeah.
What was the your story synonymous with Bathurst? You've been a winner as a driver, team boss, team owner. Do you remember the first time you went there?
Yep. First time I went there was in MGA Twin Cam, a mate's MGA Twin Cam, Norton Clayton.
So this is before the Armstrong 500 year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wire fences and, you know, and tow trucks with beams hanging out the back of them to pick you up on drag on the road. Like whatever year that was in the 60s. So the thing is, that's before I even drove with Harry. So that was like the Lotus. I was on the front row of the grid in the MGA Twin Cam with Fatty Gagan in his SP250 Daimler.
Couple of opposite cars.
I can still remember, because when he'd go around a left-hand corner, the right-hand door would fall open all the time. I think because the body's just twisted so
just
much,
popped it
the
open.
Door popped open, and he's pulling the door shut. And I said to him after the race, he said, "It's a shit of a car," which is the stutter. He was a great guy, Pete, yeah. I'll tell you a story on Pete. Pete wanted to drive our GDR one day.
Oh, I was going to ask you about this.
Go on. He said, "I want to drive the GDR." I said, sure, okay, you can drive the GDR. So we made arrangements for him to drive the GDR at Oran Park, and he was supposed to be there whatever time it was, and they made as part of the closing the circuit down for him to do a couple laps in the car and everything. That's when Scaife was driving the car, must have been back in those days. And he was late getting there, so they moved that spot. And I said, "Pete, I don't think you'll sit in the seat." And he said to me, Fred, "I'll get in the effing seat, no problem at all." And he wedged himself in the seat. He wanted to know where the gearbox was. It was a 6-speed gearbox at the time, Hollinger box. And he hopped in the car, and he's a genius, he is. He hadn't driven before, and the first time past the pits down the straight, it's flat changing, and here he is driving the car around Oran Park. And, like, you think of something like that, and he was so wrapped in driving the car, he thought it was just marvellous to be able to do that. But I need to drive your car. And he did.
He got to drive it. He got to drive it. So a legend of, you know, the 60s and 70s was driving a car here in the 90s, which was completely the opposite to anything he would have probably ever driven.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And to get in, and like to get in the seat, like, really.
Mm, physically.
He was a big man.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He said, I can well get in the seat.
Before we sat down to have a chat, you were showing me around some of the bits and pieces that you've kept over the journey. We love to talk to people on our podcast about their memorabilia, the stuff they've kept, the stuff they've collected. It's a really interesting – it's either two ways. People either keep everything and are on the border of being on those – you know those hoarder shows on TV where they've got like stuff stacked in the rooms?
Yep.
Or they've just kept nothing and they've just moved on.
Yeah.
Where are you on the scale? Have you kept stuff over the years of race suits and helmets and stuff like that? Or, you know,
I've given nothing away.
Right. Okay, well – We'll see you on the next episode of Australia's Biggest Hoarders.
I've collected everything I've ever started with. I got my original goggles in the, I think, Protector or something, cage they were.
Yeah.
They're in the thing still. I got the bracelet I used to wear with my blood group on. Used to have to
Important to know if you had a drama. Yeah,
had a drama. And I said, like, goggles. I got my yellow race suits. I raced, race suit I used to wear with the Lotus Elan. And my dad's race overalls used to wear white King G overalls. And I got my boots still, my first pair of boots, whatever the brand they are. So I've kept all those things and I've just kept collecting things. So I've got most of the things I've had over the time. I've got the drawings of David, Kevin Drage's, all these drawings that he did for the Nissan GTR, for the wheels, the uprights, all. Everything I've kept, you know, I thought, well, I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but it's all
it's
here.
Better to keep it than not keep it.
And there's a fair bit of memorabilia, trophy-wise and model car-wise, and just tried to collect things that I think, you know, I thought the kids, but, you know, our grandkids really, I've got three granddaughters, one grandson, and he lives in Canada now, and he's a hockey player. So, like, he's only a young guy. So, like, I don't think he really wants to know about the stuff that I got here.
Yeah, sure. Hardtop Falcons might not be his thing.
He's not a hockey man. Yeah, he's a hockey man. He's a ice hockey man, yeah.
You mentioned GDR. It's the 30th anniversary this year of Nissan's GDR winning the Bathurst 1000.
Is it really?
1991.
Really?
Wow. Time flies.
No wonder I'm feeling old.
Oh, come on now. Hey, take me back to we get asked so often, and there's a bunch of questions from our listeners, and I'll try to get to as many of them as I can. But the GTR is huge in all the questions we get asked, and particularly when we said we're going to be talking to you. When did the GTR project start? So it started racing here in 1990, but I guess the year before it probably came on the radar. Did you get a sniff of that car and think, hello, this is what we need. This is going to be amazing.
Well, don't forget Paul Berenger, you know, worked at Nissan Motor Company and a good mate of mine. He's still a good mate of mine. And even with the HR31s and DR30 Skyline, was still Nissan Motor Company, wasn't it really? And people like Leon Daphne and those to play. So the whole thing is they knew the GDR was coming as a road car. So I started doing some research on what this GDR was all about, you know, before it even came to Australia. And I spoke to Paul a few times about it and said, like, and we got the specs of the car and what it was going to be. And I said, that'll make a good touring car. And then he went to the company and spoke to the company about doing a limited edition cars out here. So that made it a bit better for us if we're going to do that, because we had HR31 Skylines. And being the Nissan people we were, and I was very fortunate to be given the Nissan team years before that, and building up to what it was, and if the GDR was coming, so that's when Nissan decided they had their special vehicles department, and Paul was in charge of that as well as part of product planning. So he, we decided we'll go to the company and say, hey, how about we race the GDR? It's going to be expensive.
Yeah. I was going to say, was that the next part of the question?
That was the next part of it, because the thing is, like, you couldn't have raced it as a production car here in Australia and would have been competitive against Holden and Ford and that, because the rules had changed, the regulations had changed. So we knew we had to do a lot of work to the car. We knew Japan were running the cars in Japan and winning races, but really that's all they're racing against. They're only racing against GDRs, Nissan GDRs. And the thing is, like, out here, our sport was very competitive. So the thing is, like, we knew we had to do a fair bit of work to the car. Probably didn't appreciate how much work we'd have to do, because the Japanese aren't very good at telling you the things that needs to be to go motorsport-wise. And if you had to buy something off Nismo for the car for competitive, make it competitive, would have cost an arm and a leg, because they're not cheap. You know, the cars aren't cheap and the parts off Nismo aren't cheap. So we decided to do our own car, and Nissan decided to do 100 run of cars.
Road cars.
Road cars, yeah. 100 run of road cars. And we got three of those cars, which was a shame, really. We got three of these cars, road cars, and then we turned them into two race cars.
That's actually one of our questions from one of our readers who was keen to know, were the race cars part of that bunch of road cars? So you had to take three of the 100 to turn them into races.
We turned them into races. And I can just – when they arrived at the workshop, well, the first one, we had to sort of strip it down to make it a race car. So it's all the upholstery comes out, like heaps of things come off the car that we didn't use a race car. So I must say the wrecking yard did a pretty good job. You know, he had seats and he had carpets.
He had good content for a while.
He had a lot of gear he could sell because Nissan didn't want it back. They didn't want to know about it really. So we built the race cars from road cars, yes.
Yeah. In terms of the body shells, about the only thing that probably stayed.
But, and also too, but Aaron, it was like, you know, we had to start homologating things for the car and do our own Australian homologation because the five-speed gearbox, even the one that Nismo would sell you, straight-cut gears, we could do it here much cheaper, a Hollinger box. Mm. And, of course, we knew Hollinger through the HR31 and other Nissan cars we had, and Peter Hollinger was fantastic, and the engineering he did was better than anywhere else in the world virtually. So we got a six-speed gearbox done for the GDR. We had to do new uprights for the car. We did on Kevin Drange in Adelaide that did our wheels. He did our wheels. Kevin Drange did all the castings for the uprights and things. So we Australianized the GDR in Australia. And we sort of like – I remember when we first got the first Japanese gearbox here with a five-speed dog box. And we put it in the car and went to Western Australia. And Jim did one race in it there and the shit of gearbox the next race. So I knew the gearboxes from Japan weren't going to be up to what we wanted. And because we had – they controlled the formula in Japan. Nismo did. Nissan did. The GDR was competitive. It was winning races. Everyone was buying GDRs to race.
So don't rock the boat.
Don't rock the boat.
Yeah.
In Australia, when Kakimoto-san used to come here, was the boss of Nismo. He used to come to a lot of our meetings, actually. Why did you do this, Gibson-san? Why did you do that, Gibson-san? Because we had to. So we made our own wheels, our own uprights, our own gearbox, our own turbos, everything we did in-house. We had our own turbo machine, so everything was done by us. Mm. And it became the most successful GDR in the world.
Could you have imagined – clearly, when you saw and heard about it, you thought, this is a good thing. We've got to get our hands on one of these.
Yep.
But could you have imagined what it became? Or did it exceed your expectation is probably the question.
Probably the best thing way I said it, we thought it'd arrive here and would be competitive and strong and reliable and be competitive. It was nowhere near competitive and it wasn't reliable because the thing is our touring car racing is the best touring car racing in the world. And it was then Group A. It was Group A. So everything we had to do, we had to homologate it through cams, through FIA, the gearboxes, and all the things we did to it, we had to homologate that as well. A mountain of work to do. But they become the best touring car. And like, as I said, when Kakimoto, I said, we are invited to come to Fuji for a race. Not a good idea. Very straight on the phone.
Don't bring your car in. It's going to be very fast compared to these ones.
Not a good idea because they were controlling their formula over there.
Yeah.
And anyone that run a GDR over there, it was like a Nismo-type car. Mm. And they were winning, so why they didn't need to do any more? But here it was totally different. Well, and the thing is, like people like Larry Perkins, he hated the car.
I think he still does.
He does. He does. He still hates the car. He says that. And even the HR31, he still hated that car. And he used to say to us, you're cheating. You've got to be cheating. You can't be going that well without cheating.
At least he was honest and said it to
you. Yeah, he was. He was.
What was the main – I think I remember in the start, it was a heavy car. It was quite a heavy car comparative to – some of the other things that were going on.
1,300 kilogram.
It was sort of almost Commodore-type kind of weight.
Oh, it was. Yeah, it
so
was.
So what were the first – that first year in 1990, so it turned up and Mark raced it at Malalar because Jim was fighting for the championship. So correct. It was felt, let's give Scafie the car to get the bugs out of it, and then Jimmy drove it for the last few rounds and won the championship at Oran Park. What were the main Achilles heels to begin with that you had to fix? I mean, you talked about the gearbox being one, but – what else were the problems?
Broke a front upright at for Scafie. It broke a front upright at
Malalar. That's right. Yeah,
front wheel fell off it. I think really, we had to sort of make the car a lot stronger than it was. It was too sort of weak as far as suspension was concerned. Front axles were concerned. Back axles were concerned. It wasn't the sort of thing. And say because anyone that like I used to say to our guys. I suppose when we go back to DR30, HR31 Skyline, our cars were never as competitive, so the drivers had to drive the wheels off them. And I used to say to the drivers, you do whatever you got to do to drive the car quick. However you got to treat it, whatever you got to do to it, you do it. And if it breaks something, we've got to fix that. We've got to modify that. And that's why we, with the DR30, we had to start homologating parts for the DR30 through FIA as well, through Australia and FIA. And so we knew the system we had to go through, because the DR30 wasn't competitive. You know, we had to make it competitive. And same with the HR31, it wasn't competitive. So the whole thing is, in Japan, they were competitive because they controlled the motorsport. Here, we had a lot of people like the Perkins and the Johnsons and those sort of people that hated us, because our cars, we did the right homologation, but that took time, a lot of effort and time to homologate, and all through Japan and all through JAF and then through FIA. So that's why we were late in some of our cars appearing, really, because I wouldn't run the cars unless they were safe enough to race and also reliable enough to race. And for Nissan, we didn't want to see a Nissan car breaking down all the time. And the DR30 broke down a fair bit. But, like, you know, we used to do everything in-house. Did our own engines in-house. We did our own turbos in-house. When the people from the turbo people from come out from America, they couldn't believe the things we did to our turbochargers legally, but the things we did, made bearings for them and everything in-house. Our machine shop could do anything in the workshop. And, you know, the people we had, which are still around now, you know, they are so, I suppose, technically minded from learning a lot in motorsport.
91 was when it started to really click. So Jimmy won the championship. Mark won some races, including his first championship win over in Perth, which since then has had a name change to Barbagallo and is now reverted to Wanneroo. So we can call it Wanneroo again, which is much easier for us all. And then, of course, Bathurst, I think you guys won by a lap in the end. You ran two cars that year too, Drew Price and Gary Walden in second car. And Scafie got in it and thrashed it around and broke the lap record before he killed it.
So, yeah, that's right. That's right.
How important was it to win Bathurst to you, but also to Nissan and to Japan? Did they understand how big that was? Was that more important to the champion than the championship to them?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Winning Bathurst, like, that was the golden one to win. And we knew we had to win that. And like, you look at the MD of the MDs of Nissan, they're spending a lot of money, and not a lot of money, because we had to get extra money with sponsorships, I think.
But there wasn't many. That 91 year, it was a very Nissan corporate coloured car. There was only, tiny little supply partnerships. So it was all Nissan paying the bill then, I guess.
Nissan were paying the bill then, and they knew they were paying the bill too, because that's why, like, we had to really win. We had to give them some results, really, because the thing is, like, they stuck their neck out, and probably because of Paul Berenger too, he was pushing for doing this because image, it's all about image. And Nissan didn't have the best image with Bluebird and those sorts of things, because when we raced Bluebirds, they were a fragile little car and they're always breaking down. So the whole thing is, like, you know, really this GDR or this Skyline program, because that was their main selling car, Skyline. Even in the early days, where the first Skyline race car we had was still Skyline. And especially starting a special vehicles department, they didn't want to see these Skylines on the racetrack packing up all the time. So they were under the gun as well, and we were too, cost-wise. And that's why, you know, when I took the team, I didn't realise years ago when I drove for when Howard was there, and he rang me one day and said, FG, are you interested in sort of running the race team? And I said, well, why HM? He said, well, like, you know, we're getting out of it and you can take it over if you want to. And I said, how much are you going to cost me to take it all over? He says, it's going to cost you nothing. We're giving it to you. And so the factory we had in Dandenong, that's when DR30 was on, they just said, it's all yours, all yours. And I was very fortunate, probably at that time, we must have been talking to Peter Jackson then. And he said to me, Fred, this is Howard. Oh, he said, Fred, I've got some sponsorship for you. And he said, if you want to run the workshop, you can have the whole workshop. And I thought I was going down to say to run the workshop.
As in sort of be like the manager, the workshop, not the owner.
And I walked down there. He said, oh, no, it's yours. You know, we're giving you the workshop. It's leased the building, and it's a leased building, and everything that's there, it's all yours. It's all yours. So I just walked in there, and really that's when Kristen and I and the family all moved down to Melbourne. And, it was a bit of a, wow, that was the end of Bluebird program and start a DR30 program. And when some of the guys that were left there still, when they knew I was taking over, they didn't want to work for me. So they hit the tow.
They were gone.
So I had an empty workshop with a DR30 car that wasn't homologated and had to get it all together. And I spoke to Bo Seaton, said to Seato, interested in coming to Melbourne and being the engine man. And I said, I'll give Glenn a drive in the car. Glenn can drive. And so he moved down, the family moved down to Melbourne, and he run the engine department. Trevor Jones, who started with me with my MGA, and he moved down to Melbourne, and he come down and worked me, so down here as well, and a couple other guys. And I kept road and track in Sydney going, which was my workshop in Sydney. I kept that going. I put a manager in there, kept that going, and we all moved down to Melbourne. All come down to Melbourne.
And away you went.
And away we went.
That GDR program kind of became the peak of the credit. You'd been starting down the bottom there, build up a team, build up a Skyline, go through the pain of the first few iterations of Skyline. Yeah. Each of those, you know, came with results. What do you remember about that Bathurst 91 win? Do you remember the stress? Was it that you talked about the pressure of expectation and the, you know, Nissan are spending plenty of money?
I started drinking alcohol in the 90s, I think, really, and it got worse. 91 come along. I didn't smoke, but I tell you, I was under a lot of stress. You know, I mean, we all were. You know, when we moved down there and took this program over, like, you know, I said to Christine, it's a punt we're taking. And I said, it's worth taking, you know, especially with the, Howard said, oh, he said, I've found some money from Peter Jackson for you. And it was $750,000 back in the day. That was a good sum of money back in those days, plus some Nissan money. So, I just got the people that I knew. Do you want to come down here and we do this little exercise? Yeah.
Bringing back to that GDR thing, did you feel for that – I mean, you'd been through the pain of the previous year where the car was fast. I remember Richo just blowing everyone away in the first five or six laps and getting to the – I think he bust 10 cars in two laps. It was awesome. But the next year was kind of everyone expected you were going to win.
Yes.
Did you expect to win?
No.
Really? I mean, you had such a huge advantage over everybody.
Yeah, but the car was so good. The whole thing is, but we had – you know, really, you got to develop the car. You can make the car quick, but it's quick in a touring car round. Mm. But when you got to do 1,000K – And we'd never been anywhere to do that sort of kilometres in the car. Mm. So the whole thing is to go and do a race like that. You know, we'd hoped to win and we're disappointed we didn't win, but, like, we learnt a lot. Mm. And I suppose when you've got a team of, like, probably by then we're sort of in the 20 people working for us sort of thing, you start to get sort of there as keen as mustard. And it's competitive. And the whole team was competitive and we'll make this happen. Mm. So it was a terrific result. Yeah, terrific result.
It's one of those ones that it was a breakthrough in so many ways. It's the only four-wheel drive car to win Bathurst.
Yep.
First Japanese car to win Bathurst.
Yep.
Mark's first Bathurst.
Yep.
Win of many.
Yep.
Jimmy's first in a fair while. So it had all these firsts and things that were breakthroughs and things that had not been done before or for a very long time.
Well, I think that's why in some ways I said to Christine, you know, we had Glenn down here and that sort of stuff. We had young, but I wanted an experienced driver. And she wrote down a bit of paper who she thought. I said, you write down a bit of paper who you think, and I'll write down a bit of paper who I think. And I said, because I'll go and pinch them, you know. And the thing is, Jim Richards was top of her list and my list.
And he'd been driving for Brock, hadn't he, in the BMWs?
Yes. But also too, because also BMW were pulling out, right? And the thing is, I bumped them in the dirt road at Bathurst, you know.
Where all good deals are done.
And I said, Rich, how you going, Richo? He said, yeah, good, Rift, yeah, good. I said, what are you doing next year? And he said, why? I said, how would you like to drive for us next year? And he said, FG. He said, oh, that'd be fantastic. He said, I haven't got a lot on next year. He said, that'd be fantastic. And the next question he asked me, he said, how much money are you going to pay me? Because knowing Richo how tight he is. And he said, I said, oh, whatever, forget what it was at the time. He said, that's easy. That's a done deal. We shook hands on the deal and the deal was done.
On the dirt road in Bathurst.
Yeah, the dirt road in Bathurst. Yeah,
well, don't need prolonged contract negotiations or heavy manager meetings. Just on a dirt road in
him
Bathurst,
and I, done deal. Richo and I just walking down the old pit, you know, the dirt road at the front of behind the pits. Walking down there, I just bumped into him and did a deal, and he stayed with us right through.
Long time.
And he was so good for the team because we had young drivers. He was so good for the team, he would tell them what he knew and how to drive the car differently. He was so supportive to the drivers.
He didn't try to – Scafie's told me that before. He just didn't try to hide anything.
Nothing.
Didn't play games or –
No, not at all. He was just brilliant, he was. You know, that's when Glenn decided to move on and Bo, they went and did their own thing, which was really Peter Jackson's call set, I suppose, because they said, oh, why don't you do that? Because, you know I was pretty firm in the way I run a race team, and all the guys that work for like they got looked after very well. Like we do all their laundry, and we'd sort of have the workshop was one of the best workshops in the country. It turned out to be, but Jim was just so good with everyone else in the whole place that when Glenn left, I had to start to get someone else organised as well. And then sort of then Scafie come along anyway, and Jim taught Scafie heaps. Mm. He was just no problem at all. Yeah.
He says he taught him a bit about beer drinking as well as race driving.
Oh, jeez. He used to call him the guinea pig. You try it first, Scafie. He used to call him Scafie the guinea pig. You try it first, guinea pig. If the wheels fall off and something, you might get hurt. It's better you getting hurt than me getting hurt. especially when he crashed the car at Adelaide.
Oh, yes.
That was a bad accident. I said, because they went out in that first practice session.
And this is the GDR, at the Grand Prix, when he put it on its lid, yeah.
And they go out and all of a sudden Scafie didn't come round. And I said to Rich, Richo, you seen Scafie anywhere? And he said, FG, yes. And I said, is he crashed? He said, yes, he's crashed. And I said, oh, shit. And I said, how bad's the car? He said, we used to have this drinking competition. He said, it's a small bottle shop.
It's what he owes the team.
That's what he owes the team, a small bottle shop. Because it was right off. It was written
off. Yeah, it was a write-off. It was a write-off. Gone. One of the five. There were five GDRs weren't there for racing for your team. And
yeah.
There's four still around, but that's the one that
she got wrote off.
Didn't last long.
She survived. And that knocked Scafie about, knocked his brain about a fair bit, and I think he's still got the same problem with his brain now.
There's actually a couple of questions about Mark and crashes and things a bit later on, but it makes sense to me now. He's some of his stories as a younger bloke while in your employ, I think he and Traddy had a bit of an incident one day with a road car doing a bit of racing in some back streets of Dandenong. So I guess with you, you talked about your inner hoon on the road as a young bloke. I guess you could identify a little bit with a bit of that, although at the time I'm sure you weren't really thinking quite that way.
No, I wasn't really at all, because like the thing is there was Anthony Tratt, who used to drive a Porsche and that sort of thing. They were good mates, and you got Glenn down here and you had Scafie down here, and we put them in a house together when they were down here.
That's
so
dangerous.
That was very dangerous, very dangerous. I said to Chris, we've got to put these guys, young guys somewhere. We've got to have rented a house and put them in a house. That was disaster. And the thing is, the things they used to get up there, the three of them actually all together. And with Jim's ex, you know, I wouldn't do that, but you should give it a go. I haven't seen a bad accident lately or something like. Jim was terrific. But I was in Japan and I got back on the morning flight and I hopped in the car. I went across to see Nissan first and I went across to the workshop. And he said, I need to see you. I said, Scafie, I'm busy. He said, Fred, you need to see me. I said, I need to see you, do I? Why do I need to see you? He said, there's been a little problem. And I said, what's the problem? He said, well, actually, he said, the gazelle I had. And I said, yeah. He said, I rolled it over. I said, you rolled it over. I said,
this is the road car, not the race car. Gazelle.
You rolled it over. How'd you do it? He said, Traddy and I were blazing down past the main street of Nissan on the main road. And he said, got a touch-up, and it turned over. Who touched up? He said, Traddy, give me a touch-up, and turned over. I said, oh, I got it. And he said, that's not the worst part. I said, oh, what's the next part? He said, there was a copper hiding in the bushes with a radar gun. And he said, but the worst thing has happened too, but I had my new fiberglass briefcase, and it flung out and got on the road and ran over it.
All worried about the bloody briefcase than the car.
Yeah, so the cop was in the road, the cop was, so I had to go to court and fight him in court to get Chad in him out of a court case. Oh, they were a pretty disaster, two of them. And then Richo's priming them up all the time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Good fun. It was good. Thing is, we were a team.
Hmm.
All the guys that worked for us.
Yeah, a lot of guys that stayed there for a long time.
Worked day and night. They would work day and night, and they still ring up, and we all talk to each other and the whole thing. And I've still got the list of people we sort of had working there. And, you know, we had some good people. And even we had a couple of guys that went back to New Zealand, a couple of Kiwis, and they still keep in touch. So the team was a very close-knit team.
Hmm.
I remember I got off the plane one day in Darwin, and all the teams got off, and Dick's team got off, and they had shorts and thongs on, and a T-shirt, and looking like rubble, they did. And I said, our team will never look like that. So after that, we finished up. We supplied the team with clothes. When we were in the plane, it wore a tie, shirt, sports jacket, all the clothes we supplied the whole lot. So when they travelled, they used to go on the VIP lounge at the airports. They used to get looked after. They used to get all their washing done at work. We used to have a washing machine there, and they had people that we used to wash all the clothes, dry clean all the clothes. Our team got looked after better than any other team in the country.
Fred, stop, because the guys who work for me will want this as part of their deal for next year. They want me to do their washing for them.
Oh, God.
I struggle to do my own washing, let alone anyone else's.
Well, that's why we got our own cook.
Yeah.
We got our own cook. Colin did our cooking.
Stop, mate. Now they're going to want me to supply lunch at the office as well. Steady on. I buy them a coffee every now and then. This podcast has cost me an arm and a leg, mate. We need to move on to the next topic.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, the National Motor Racing Museum up at Bathurst is great friends of ours. They've got some amazing stuff on display up there. And we bring via them the Couch Racer Questions segment of our podcast. Mm-hmm. Basically, we've had a bunch of fans send in a bunch of questions, and hopefully you can answer them as best as you can.
Yep.
There's a couple along the way here that might help solve or dispel some myths about GTR. There's all sorts of stuff that floats out there in social media world. So you might be able to stamp a few out or support a few to say that they're actually true as well from some of our listeners. So Glenn McGill asks the first one. He said, is it true? Now, when someone starts with one of these, you know
That's a problem.
Yeah, it's a problem. It could be a problem. Is it true back in the day of the GTR, when it got a weight or performance penalty, rather than adding lead, you upgraded the bolts throughout the chassis to better distribute the weight and effectively make the car stronger?
No, we didn't do that, but he's on the right track.
Right.
We had to put extra weight in the car. So the rear cross member on the car is a steel cross member in the back of the independent rear suspension, and we filled it all up with lead. The cross member was all filled with lead weights in it. We pulled the cross member apart. We filled with lead, so it was down low to the ground. Down low to the ground, because you know cross member goes down the ground, and so our cross member was a very heavy cross member, and that was where some of the extra weight went. Yep.
Was that legal?
Yep, absolutely, okay. Absolutely.
Okay, so he's sort of on the right.
Yeah, he's on the right track. Yep.
Ian Stenhouse, this is an interesting one. What are your thoughts on TCR? You've been around touring car racing a long time, and all the different eras of.
I think it's fantastic. I think we can have two VA supercars at present right now is, to me, I'd enjoy TCR better than VA supercars.
Is that the racing purist in you?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Because they're sports sedans.
Hmm.
Yeah, a touring car now, like the touring cars that are running now, they're sports sedans, really what sports sedans used to be years ago. And the TCR are sort of like touring cars.
Closer to a traditional touring car.
I'm not knocking either of them.
No.
What I'm saying is I think TCR is going to go well. I think I'd enjoy seeing it. I've seen a couple of the British touring cars that are here in Australia. Alan Heavey's got one in his workshop there, Nissan. So I see what they've done. And the rules started to get out of control even when they raced them overseas with the engines turned around back to front and all those sorts of stuff.
Tourers went through the roof.
It went through the roof as well. But I think really, to me, I think it'll go very well. And I think people backing it are pretty experienced and pretty financial. And I think it'll go good.
I think it fits a spot.
It does.
Yeah. You know, more racing, the better. I know we're a small market and there's only going to be so much corporate and commercial money going around, but I think
we're losing to touring car racing like it was really, we started with two-door cars, Windy, and it's like...
We ended up back there.
Back there again, haven't we, really? With the two-door cars again.
Yeah.
Four-doors again. It's a pity, like you see Holden pull the plug on those sorts of things. So you're losing the four-door car, touring cars, what it used to be like. Yeah.
Well, it's like you drive around on the road now. Very rare that you'll find, I mean, it's SUV land out there.
Yeah,
SUVs, utes, small cars.
Well, there's an opportunity for you, SUV racing.
Oh, really? No, mate. They tried the super thing with diesels and it didn't really work.
So either, yeah.
Just because it's selling lots on the road, I don't think it makes good racing just quality.
I agree.
Luke Blattman, actually, this is a super touring related question. Luke asks, how close did Gibson Motorsport get to running a super touring program in Australia? You were linked to running Nissans and later Vectras because you had some Holden tyres later on. Was it ever close, running a two-litre thing, or was it always just a bit of chat?
Looked at very closely because Alan Heave was involved in England with Super Tourist sort of thing.
With Nissan.
Nissan. And he's got an actual Nissan Super Tourist in his workshop. So the whole thing is it did get fairly close to sort of maybe we should do something like
with
that.
With Nissan?
Yeah. With Nissan. And they were keen to do it, but I think really – the little car thing didn't suit Nissan what they wanted to do, even though they did the Bluebird thing. And the Bluebird really, even they manufactured the Bluebird in Australia, but it wasn't really successful for Nissan winning races with the Bluebird because the Bluebird became a pretty expensive little car to run. And we're running against the Commodores and the Falcons. So the whole thing is even back in those days, we'd beat them, but like if you knew how we beat them and how illegal the cars were to beat them and the rules changed to do that, you know, so it was never going to be any good.
Nothing with Holden, nothing with Vectras, nothing along those lines?
No, not really. No, it was more a Nissan thing rather than a Vectra thing, so the Holden thing, yeah.
Yep. Yep. Matt's question, which of the Bathurst wins, of one as a driver, three as a team owner slash manager, which of those wins was the most satisfying?
All of them. any win at Bathurst is satisfying, really. I suppose the first GDR win was satisfying because I knew how much hung on the balance there with that. Because, you know, we'd spent a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of Nissan's money, and the whole thing is when the GDR first, it was a fragile car to compete against the other cars, and it had to be sort of made much more reliable. So really probably the Bathurst and Nissan win. But I suppose also too, but, you know, my first win at Bathurst with Harry, that was a pretty special thing for me to do as well with the GT Falcon sort of thing.
GT back then, a GTR a little bit later. It was sort of a bit the same-ish, but that was about where the similarities ended. And that was, and I know you've talked about this many times in the past, but Frank Maddich was supposed to drive with Harry. Yeah. He couldn't.
Yeah.
You get the call up.
Yeah.
You meet him on the Friday night or whatever it was.
On the Friday night in his pyjamas.
That's the best story.
Yeah.
I mean, these days they're announcing their co-drivers for Bathurst in February.
And
here you are 2 days out from the race. Of course, at the time, it wasn't the behemoth that it is now. Yeah. It was five years into its history. Gallagher 500 by.
But I suppose also too, but yeah, that day I spoke to Harry and that night I spoke to Harry, he said that cock will win the race. And he was so confident. But when you find out the things that Harry used to do too, it's probably no wonder we won the race because it was a good car.
But in a legal way or just a few smart little things?
Yeah, smart little things that H should do to make it a better car. And he did, and probably learned a lot off him in those era for when Ford Motor Company with Big Al here and those sorts of things. Mm. Because people can't believe how bad those cars were doing Bathurst.
Mm.
You know, you'd have no brakes after five or six laps or something sort of thing.
It's funny how everyone thinks glory days, golden era.
Yeah.
When you compare and contrast, though, you go, oh, my God.
Oh God. But when you look at
When you don't know any different.
Well, you look at a HO, you're doing 150 mile an hour down the straight of Bathurst, 150 mile an hour, and you've got a Mini Cooper S or something there, like, you know, those sorts of cars and everything. And you come across the hump, and we used to tell the guys with the small cars, watch the windsock, because we'd come off the ground.
Mm.
And if we would decide something, we'd just swat one.
You can't steer it if it's in midair.
And then when you get in into the straight for the braking area, and you've got your foot hard on the throttle, and the left foot's pumping the brake up, so you had a pedal at the end of the brake to stop the car. So the thing is, and you do that for basically the whole race. So it's a whole different aspect of racing to what they do now, for sure.
Yeah.
They're race cars now.
They weren't racing cars. Yeah. It's a very important distinction.
Yeah.
Peter Alexander, he's a massive Ford fan. He's a regular reader of our page and our stuff. He said, when the new regs came in for the V8 era, 1993, you weren't Holden. You had a lot of history with Fords. I think Scafie and yourself have talked about this over the years. How close or what consideration was there that you would go with Ford rather than with Holden, given you'd had a tie in there in the past?
It was pretty close, but it wasn't close because Holden just did a better deal. Mm. You know, it was just they wanted us desperately. And I can't think of the marketing guy back in those days. They knew we were going to go well.
Oh, Rob McInerney?
Rob McInerney. No, he wanted us in Holden, and we went Holden. And no other reason than that. It was just a better deal, you know, really. Because, you know, I suppose also to then getting back to Ford with the Lowndes deal, that was because of who was the president of Ford then?
Jeff Pilates.
And he's the one that, you know, got me back in that little deal again because, you know, he was just wanted to go motor racing again.
Mm.
And he was an unbelievably good MD.
It was funny at the time, just as we record this, the Australian Open tennis has just finished.
Yep.
And it occurred to me watching the tennis the other night that which Key has had a long involvement with now, but remember it was the Ford Australian Open.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And that deal ended in 2000 ahead of – they really went hard into V8s, obviously the Lowndes deal and the Double O Gibson deal. And they, you know, Steve Richards ended up with a Ford tick. They put a big amount of effort into their V8 supercar program. I think they used a lot of the tennis money to divest across to the motorsport. But watching that the other night, I think they played an old bit of vision with the green courts and the blue – signage of Ford, which took me right back to that sort of era of what you're talking about there. It's funny how time has flown that stuff. But another one for me to throw in is when that Ford Gibson Lowndes thing happened, what was the story? Wasn't there some stuff about maybe a South Australian government Commodore team that you were potentially getting involved or could have got involved in? What was the state of that at the time? Because I guess for our listeners, we should rewind it, that Gary Dumbrell had come along with Wins and sort of forged with you. Scafie left to go to HRT. Yep. You ran Wins cars for a couple of years, won Bathurst with Murph and Richo in 99. 2000 was Kmart and he acquired the team.
Yep.
So was this in 2000 when you were out and he was running?
Yeah, but the whole thing is you've got to think back in those days, the money wasn't there.
Mm.
The money wasn't there and the whole thing is with Gary Dumbrell and all that stuff and Wins money, it all looked fantastic and financial and that, but we were scratching.
Hmm.
We were scratching. And then and like even Gary, when he finished up buying the business off me sort of thing, he couldn't afford to buy the business and those sorts of things.
Did you think that you were done with racing at that point when you sold that? You were, I'm done. I've had the time.
It's all over because we couldn't do motorsport the way I wanted to do motorsport. And the thing is, that was the big secret of it all, I suppose. Like, if you can't do something well, don't do it at all.
Mm.
And I've had a lot of money over many years of motorsport and give good result for the money we've had. But the thing was with Gary and that, there was never the money, even the Wins money or whatever, to do it as well as we could. And we did well, we did pretty well, but didn't really sort of like do it at the top level. And then the Ford deal come up, where they wanted to go racing again, Jeff Pilates was the one that started all that off.
Mm.
You know?
So was that Adelaide thing a thing at all with Commodores?
No, it was bit of government talk, and the government put some money in and do something, and we looked at a factory over there where we were going to have a workshop and that, but it really was just, you know, when it comes down to the dollars and you say it's going to cost you $1 million, say, they collapse on the floor, don't they?
Well, that ends that deal.
But it's amazing how, like, also, too, if I can just talk about the Lowndes deal.
Mm, which we've got some questions about that era, too, yeah.
The Lowndes deal, like, you know, Tom had him under contract.
Tom Walkinshaw.
Tom had him under contract. And Craig's legal people were talking to Tom about doing it. And I, in my crude way, I said, well, stop stuffing about. Do you want Lowndes to get him out of his contract with Walkinshaw? They said, yeah. I said, well, I'll do it. I said, it's going to cost you money. Mm. Simple as that.
Money fixes and changes stuff.
And the thing is, it was the Grand Prix. and was supposed to race that weekend, and Craig wasn't still free to drive the car.
Legally. Like he was entered and there was the car.
Because Tom still had him under contract.
Yeah.
And I said, and all the gurus were doing the job. They're all the marketing people and they're all doing their thing trying to do this deal. So I just bumped into Tom at the Grand Prix on the Friday. Thursday might have been and said, Tom, he didn't know him. I didn't know him that well. So he said, I said, like, Tom, this is bullshit. Like, we've got to do something. What do you want to do? He said, well, how much money will you give me? And I forget the number I did, but it was a good lump of money.
To pay out the contract.
He said, deal's done. Shook hands. I went back out and I said to Craig's legal people, give Tom so much money and he can drive the weekend. So it was pretty simple. All this rooting around that we're doing, trying to do these deals, they just didn't understand Tom. Tom was a hard-nosed bugger, but he was a fair guy. And when he said to me how much he wanted, and it was a couple hundred grand or something sort of thing, I said, well, that's a deal. Shook hands.
Get it done.
Mm.
Yeah. Was it the fact that it was Lowndes in that deal that made you go, all right, I'm coming back, I'll get involved?
Yeah,
if it was anybody else, would you have bothered?
I don't know, because Jeff Pilates rang me and said, like, we want to get back into the sport again. And he said, this young Craig Lowndes, what can we do with him again? And I said, well, yeah, he'd do a good job. And of course he'd do a good job. And so that's the only reason we got him back in again, sort of, really. But that fell apart because of deals and sponsorship and didn't work. It was never going to work,
One of those ones, and I don't want to press onto those topics of stuff that went wrong, but I guess we've seen other situations in the past. I think Brock had this scenario too with the wheels where it was Team Brock, but it was their team. In that instance, Bob Forbes was been involved and you guys had had a long association with the GDRs and he ran a customer car and stuff like that.
Yep.
It was Gibson Motorsport logo and name
and
you obviously sort of at the front of it really, but in essence behind it, he was the business,
Forbes was the man. He's the one that sort of was pushing the issue to do it again, sort of thing, really. And I knew Bob wouldn't have the money to do it properly and didn't have the sponsorship, so it fell apart pretty quickly. And then we become enemies, really, in some ways. Yeah, which is sad.
Yeah, I'm sad. It's sad to see how that all went and got legal and all that sort of stuff. But I tell you one thing, though, mate, that the green-eyed monster car. Is iconic. Whenever we throw a photo up on social media of Lowndes or wherever he was racing back in those couple of years with that car, distinctive, the livery, it didn't win much, to be honest. It didn't win much, but it made a mammoth impression. And here we are 20 years on, people go nuts.
Yeah.
Fans love it.
Well, Noel Watson designed all that.
Mm.
Now, when Noel had his marketing company, and he was a mate, he lived at Mount Eliza and that sort of stuff. And so he was involved in that little deal. But it all fell apart because it was probably never going to work. I suppose you're grasping on the side of the hill, thinking it's going to work. Get Craig in a car, the green-eyed monster. They did a good job of designing that; it looked fantastic. Jeff Pilates, the boss of Ford Motor Company, wanted to do it, sort of thing. And what about it when I said the Ford? You said about the Ford Oval on the side. And I think I said something about we're going to paint it silver or something. Did it finish up being silver the fourth?
Silver, black sort of thing, yeah.
And I said to – he said to me, Pilates said, Fred, he said, the Ford logo is never those colours. I don't know how I'm going to get away putting that through the system. And I said, well, let's do it and see what happens. And which we did, and it looked fantastic.
Yeah.
But it was blue and white normally. The Ford logo wasn't it really. Here we are, us on the side of the car. Hinley died when he said, "Oh God,
this is not meeting corporate communications. This is not logo use good. Guidelines.
Not going to be good on Monday morning at head office." He was a terrific guy.
They really did go boots in that area with Ford for sure. Yeah. Another question here from Michael Gray: what was your greatest moment as a driver?
It's
a good question, isn't it, actually?
Good question.
Might not necessarily have been a win.
I suppose it'd have to be winning Bathurst in 67 with Harry. Because that came out the blue. I think I did a pretty good job of that weekend because Harry just kept me in the car.
Kept going.
He was the mechanic. He was the mechanic.
He was Jim and you were Mark.
Yeah,
he was the guinea pig.
Yeah. And I think that was good. And probably winning that – disappointment was the next year. We should have won again. because it got a stand for the radiator.
You and Bo.
Me and Bo.
Yeah.
In Harry's car. But I couldn't believe also when we arrived at Bathurst and with Harry and his team, it was a works team, and they're in a tent at the back, and there's a trailer with shit everywhere in the back of the trailer, and oh, God, stripe. This is the Ford works team. Because I met Harry well before that when we did the 60,000-kilometre thing around the Yu Yangs.
It was a big proving ground, Ford's proving ground, where they did just whatever the current model Falcon was, just kilometres and
two
kilometres
and
kilometres.
Two-door XL or whatever they were, and we just went around 70,000 k's, 70,000 miles, 70,000 k's.
Either way, it's a long way.
We flew from Sydney, Bo and I and the Gagans and that, because they were running out of drivers for that.
More blokes.
We're wearing them all out.
They're
wearing them. They were just going round.
Keep going. It's a big thing back in then, doing those sort of time distance runs to show reliability of road cars and performance.
Ford didn't have that reliability thing back in those days, I don't think. The XM or XLs, whatever they were. And they wanted to do that, and they did it. I know the heavy from America was there. The president from Ford America was here, and we did that. And it was hard work, And Harry, we started racing. Just a quick story on that, out of sight around the back of the Yu Yangs, all us drivers, we'd drive the wheels off the Falcon because we're supposed to be taking it easy and look after them. And as you go past where all the pits were and where they do the pit work and everything, out of sight again, and all razor. And all of a sudden, but what happened was Harry and Harry and one of the heavies there went out at the back and watched us, and Les Powell, he was the motorsport boss, Les Powell, he stopped the whole thing. Got all the drivers together and said, "We've been round the back watching you guys, and as from now," because they were pulling, they were running out of tyres, Dunlop SPs, the Dunlop SP250s, they were pulling wheels off cars on the showroom floor and with tyres on, take down there, they're running out of tyres.
Because you blokes were using them up.
Yeah, we used them up, sorry about that.
That was part one of our chat with Fred Gibson. He was in very good form, and I can happily tell you that part two next week covers even more National Motor Racing Museum couch racer questions, and we get Fred to tackle the Motor Focus Top 10 Shootout. Don't forget to jump on our online bookshop. It's bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. Bunch of great books and magazines, prints and racing DVDs for you to add to your collection. Of course, don't forget you can pre-order the Larry Perkins car history book. Plenty of interest too, I reckon, one day, if we ever did the cars of Gibson Motorsport. If you like that idea, send us a note on the socials. Don't forget to, every Monday, Repco Supercars Weekly. It's a part of our V8 Sleuth podcast series. It's our look at the Repco Supercars Championship with some news, updated points, all of the tidbits and bits and pieces of info that will keep you ticking between the races, in the lead up to the rounds, and of course in the aftermath of rounds too. Follow us on socials, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, you know the deal, and sign up to our newsletter through our v8sleuth.com.au website. You'll get regular links to our news stories. You'll get advice of when new products are landing, when pre-orders are opening for things. It's your way to keep in touch with us, and it's our way to keep connected to you. In the meantime, that's been another episode of the V8 Sleuth podcast powered by Repco. We'll chat to you soon.